This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of Letters from Kayfabe. And I'm here once again with Alan. How are you doing this week, Alan?
I'm great, Parv. I'm excited to get going with what's in the sack, again, let's just call it. We got a proper name for our mailbag, or are we just going to refer to it as the sack?
Well, it's the mailbag, isn't it?
Well, it's the mailbag, but I like to, you know, shake my sack. Or,
Alan's,
you know,
sack, I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, there's many permutations we could go with, but we'll stick with mailbag for now then, Parv. What do you think?
All right, let's hit it.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
All right, well, let's go into the first one then. So, dear Alan and Parv, I remember seeing the Brooklyn Brawler winning some matches in 1989. Did this really happen? And that's from Jason Weber in Fall River, Massachusetts. So, Brooklyn Brawler winning matches in 89. Do you want to start us off on this one, Parv?
Yeah, well, I want to say that he did win some matches in 1989. Steve Lombardi had been around. I think he was around all the way from about 82, 83. As a generic job guy. But then he disappears from screen for a while and comes back as the Brooklyn Brawler under the charge of one Bobby the Brain Heenan. And this was all about the feud with the Red Rooster that had been going on between Heenan and Terry Taylor, because Heenan had basically said that he could take anybody, any scrub from off the streets, basically, and make them a big star. And, you know, Red Rooster was an up-and-comer at that time. And, you know, basically he wasn't listening to Heenan's instructions exactly. And it all came to a head on one particular show where Heenan got in Red Rooster's face, slapped him. Rooster took exception and, you know, essentially turned on his manager there and then. And then the following week, Heenan brings in the Brooklyn Brawler from the streets of New York in order to, you know, teach the Red Rooster a lesson and also to prove that he can take anybody from the streets and make them a star. And I want to say as part of that run, the Brooklyn Brawler would have had a few victories, at least over jobbers. Do you know if he beat anyone more significant than your basic jobbers at that time?
Well, Steve Lombardi, he beat a few people in 89, but just to start off on him, Steve Lombardi, what an interesting guy. He's definitely one of those guys that knows where the bodies are buried at Titan Towers, isn't he? He's been around long enough. There's a few people like him that definitely, you know a bit more than they probably want to know. So there's him, I would say. There's going to be someone like Howard Finkel and, you know, maybe Kevin Dunn as well. Those three who've been around forever. I know Brooklyn Brawler's not with the company anymore, but, you know, they'll have seen a few things that they've had to keep quiet about over the years.
Yeah, it does seem like one of those mysteries. Like, how did he continue to be employed all the way through? It was 82 all the way to, like, this century, basically.
Oh yeah, it was only in the last few years that he was let go. But he kind of got into the business in a weird way. Well, not a weird way, but he had no formal training as such, where he hung around kind of shows, and someone helped him get backstage, and he made a good impression on people like Snooker in Morocco. He used to go to MSG every month, and eventually, you know, he got his break in the business. He went in and he trained with Master Saito, who would, you know, stretch him, kill him. He kept coming back. Master Saito basically recommended that he goes to community college so he'd be eligible for a wrestling team. He took judo classes and started weight training. And then in 82, you know, he got his shot on being a jobber. So an interesting way in. And, you know, as we said, he'd been around forever. But getting back to what you said before about him in 89, how he started, you know, the actual angle on TV was quite interesting. He basically blindsided the Red Rooster. Bobby Heenan was with the Red Rooster, sorry, Terry Taylor and Gorilla Monsoon in the studio, offered to shake his hand, say, look, let's go our separate ways. Taylor comes to shake his hand, and then from behind, with a bar stool, comes Brooklyn Brawler, who clocks Terry Taylor first, but then he actually clocks Gorilla Monsoon, doesn't he, Parv?
Yeah, I was really shocked by that, because Monsoon takes a full bump there in 1989, which is long, long after the time that he'd last been in the ring. I want to say Monsoon's last match was maybe in 81, 82, something like that.
He was long retired, and then what he did was he slammed Terry Taylor into a locker, and it looked like it was made of paper. It kind of destroyed quite easily. So that was kind of the TV introduction to the Brooklyn Brawler character. But he debuted in early 89 on screen, and he beat people at first, like Reno Riggins and Lanny Poffo, and you know, people of that ilk, Mario Mancini, Paul Roma, but. And he, with the Red Rooster, you know, on the road, it was him with Boston Garden. He got beaten by the Red Rooster. On Superstars, he got beat by the Red Rooster. He beat the Red Rooster a few times as well. For example, he beat him in an MSG show. But he was nothing more than a prelim guy that won a few matches. So like we've said in previous episodes, definitely just a jobber to the stars. He never really went over anyone above someone like a Paul Roma.
Yeah, and what's quite interesting with Brooklyn Brawler is that I don't know if he was ever officially a member of the Heenan family, but after WrestleMania, which is where that whole feud blows off, was it WrestleMania 5 in 1989?
Yeah, that's right.
They basically make no mention of it again, and you don't really see Heenan, like, the connection between Brawler and Heenan is gone by that time. He does have, like, a few skits here and there, though. I seem to remember one from a Coliseum home video, Alan. Tell me if you remember this, where Brooklyn Brawler is in a restaurant. This is around the time that Sherry is with Ted DiBiase, and they're sitting down for a meal, and he's basically piggish over the meal. That's like an extra on the World Tour Coliseum tape.
I remember that vaguely, and he's probably very piggish because of his payoffs. If he was only doing prelim matches all his career, he's not going to be rolling in cash, is he?
Well, I mean, that's the old thing that they say, that Gorilla Monsoon got the same pay as a prelim guy for every single show for the entirety of his run. After
God.
That was part of his buyout clause. So.
Well, that's not a bad deal. But I remember as well with Gorilla Monsoon, about the time when Skinner came in, he always remarked in Skinner matches that Brooklyn Brawler would make a good tag team partner for him. So I don't know why he was pushing that on screen. What a combo. That would be Steve Kern and the Brawler in 93, kind of time, 92, 93. So that's the kind of thing that stood out for me. But yeah, in 89, he had that little run with Terry Taylor. And then after that, he was getting beat by everyone. Like even Al Perez was beating him on MSG shows in November 89. So he was basically a few months, and that was him done. He was on TV for years after, all the way up until the last few years, really. He'd make cameos and things like that. He'd be in the Gimmick Battle Royal, and he was known quite well for his actual level of push, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think like by the end of 89, you can, a match that I would point to show that he's got absolutely nothing going on at all is the defeat, that, you know, the losing effort, Alan, that he has to Mr. Perfect. Because obviously Mr. Perfect was a heel, and you know, that basically shows that it doesn't matter what alignment he is. He's, you know, he's so low that it doesn't matter if he's good or evil. He's just going to lose. You know,
I think what helped him keep his job for a long time was his kind of link to Pat Patterson, whatever way that was, because Pat Patterson trained him as well. He's one of the guys that kind of started him off. You know, I mentioned Master Saito before. It was kind of Pat Patterson who was credited for training him, and you know, they were friends. They, you know, whatever the rumors were, but they kind of he stuck around, and I think having someone like Pat Patterson batting for you for years kind of kept him in a job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know anything about the rumors about that, because as far as we know, Pat Patterson had a committed partner for all of those years who followed him everywhere. So I wouldn't want to insinuate anything on that. But I think you're right that if you've got someone in the inner circle looking out for you, you know, maybe they can ensure that you have a job. But he was also doing things behind the scenes as well, I want to say, that he was involved in the office in some way. Even if it was just getting coffees for people, I don't know.
Yeah, he had some involvement there, and he stuck around, as we said, for years. So that's kind of, hopefully that answers Jason's question about Brawler. He did win some matches in 89, but not enough to kind of write home about. So shall we move on to the second question we've got?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. So next one is, Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler is Akeem. Someone told me that he was the same person as One Man Gang. Is that right? And that comes from Chadley Crisolo in Norwich, Connecticut. So we've moved on now, Chadley. Your favourite wrestler is now Akeem. So, again, are we improving week on week here?
Well, some people would argue that One Man Gang is a very good wrestler, especially those that saw him wrestle in the Bill Watts territory. Some people rate him very highly. Akeem, well, I mean, he's certainly, I would say, arguably a bigger star than some of Chadley's previous picks. At the time that we're talking about, because, you know, the 88 run is quite a big main event slot, I would say, against the Mega Powers.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, Akeem himself, his run was, you know, 2 years, funnily enough. He made his debut in October of 88 as the Akeem character on screen. He had his vignette, which we'll talk about in a moment, just before that. And then he lasted all the way up till November 1990. So, you know, a good 2 year run in that gimmick. So do you want to just talk us through how it happened from the One Man Gang to Akeem?
Yes, so just before that, I do have a couple of little personal things about Akeem. He is one of my one of my favorite wrestling memories. Alan is sitting with my brother, and I can't remember exactly which promo it was. I think it was on one of the WrestleManias, maybe, where Boss Man and Akeem and Slick are giving a promo, and you know, he did all that kind of jiving and making faces, and there's this tiny little moment, and I'll see if I can post the exact promo with the show notes, where Boss Man, you can see he looks at Akeem's face, and you can just see him starting to crack up. You can see that, you know, it's making him laugh, the goofy faces he's making, and you can just see the moment of recognition in Boss Man's face there. He's trying whatever he can not to burst out laughing. And my brother, for some reason, really, really got obsessed with that promo, and he'd play it, and then he'd rewind it, and then he'd play it again. And by the, you know, after 10 minutes of this, we'd just be on the floor in tears of laughter at Boss Man and Akeem during that promo. He was very funny, I thought. He really did embrace what he was given to do. So what happened is that we're taken to an alleyway somewhere in the slums of New York. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever seen the, it kind of reminds me of like the sort of street that you'd see in the old arcade game Final Fight, something like that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Or maybe the movie The Warriors?
Yes, that's the one. Warriors come out to play, yeah. It looks like something out of Warriors. You know, so you've got like bins that are on fire and things like this, trash cans, as Americans would say. And Gorilla Monsoon is there on occasion because Slick is going to show him something incredible.
Imagine that. You just say, right, just picture this for a minute. So you've got Slick, just calls Mean Gene one day and says, you know what, Mean Gene, I need you to come down to the set of the Warriors, and what I need you to do is come and find me. I'm not going to tell you exactly where I am. I just want you to wander aimlessly for a little bit, and then you're going to come and find me, and I'm going to tell you why I want you to meet me here. And Mean Gene went, yeah, sure, when you're free. And then
Mean Gene had, he'd wandered these streets before with Murdoch and Adonis years previous, so he wasn't scared of anything, I don't think. but basically, he does find Slick hanging out on the corner with with a very large kind of ghetto blaster over one shoulder.
Oh yeah, totally stereotypical here. With, you know, in this era, it's awesome ghetto blaster. We need to see more ghetto blasters in wrestling. I miss them.
One of the funniest things I'll tell you, Alan, is that it was a little bit later in the town that I grew up, Porth Gore, which is this little town in Wales, not a rough place really, it's by the sea. This boy in our school had he'd been to America. He'd been to, like, going to live in New York, and then he was coming back. And, you know, he picked up the American accent and things. And like, oh, yeah. I remember he'd be, like, walking through, like, the summer field in town with a ghetto blaster over his shoulder. This was, like, 1992, 93.
Amazing. Amazing. I love the way you referenced Summerfield then as well. You're dating it quite well there, Parv.
So, that just gave me a flashback that there were people in real life who actually did this thing in
Wales, in the
deepest,
90s.
Darkest Wales in the 90s. Well, you know, Wales is a good 5 years behind the time, so, you know. Anyway, what happens is that Slick is in this alleyway, and this is a bit of it that I didn't really understand, Alan. There are lots of different African kind of tribal people around in this street in wherever they are. Now, how did Slick get these people from, you know, the jungles of Africa into this street? I mean, it must have been some personal expense for Slick to get all of these people, even on a plane in the first place.
Well, it would have done there. I mean, you know, getting those many people there to help. Maybe they were the ones that helped Akeem or the One Man Gang find his roots, because One Man Gang, tough street biker from the mean streets, he may have been, it could have happened in a different way. These guys could have been, you know, just on holiday, and there's a One Man Gang with his bikers, you know, acting all mean, and he sees these guys in these colourful robes and making all these chants, and he thought, you know what, I'm going to find my African roots, even though it's extremely inflammatory and racist. I don't care, I'm going to find my African roots, and I'm going to act like an African, or what? Well, it's not really an African, is it? I mean, the whole idea of the gimmick was making fun of Dusty Rhodes. I mean, Dusty Rhodes was the American dream, so Akeem was the African dream. And he kind of turned the Dusty Rhodes mannerisms up to about a million. And it was so stupid, racist, and vindictive, you know, poking fun at Dusty Rhodes. But, you know, for me and you as fans at the time, it was priceless. It was an awesome gimmick. So getting back to actually what happened, Parv. So he meets Mean Gene, and, you know, you've got all the tribe there. And then what happens?
Well, One Man Gang does turn up. I'm trying to remember exactly what happens now. Like, they circle around a flaming fire, and One Man Gang is there. And Mean Gene keeps on trying to call him One Man Gang. And every time he does so, he says, he's not One Man Gang. His name is Akeem. Call him Akeem from now on. And basically, during this ritual, something happened. It's like Akeem gets rhythm in his bones from Slick's ghetto blaster. This is so bizarre, because it's like the thing that doesn't make much sense to me is that you've got the African tribal side of it, but you've also got like Slick, who's clearly not African, or, you know, he's basically just like a guy with rhythm.
He's a
pimp with a ghetto blaster and who likes dancing. So it's almost like he infects One Man Gang with the soul of Slick, which it may be in Slick's heritage has a bit of African ancestry, obviously, because he's an African American, but it's not just the African part. He inherits like the jive soul bro part of Slick as well.
Well, yeah, it was just explained that he just discovered his African roots, and that was it. And, you know, the kayfabe exclamation was that Slip, he kind of channeled some Africanness through a mysterious kind of tribal ritual. That was kind of the only kind of thing that was explained on TV. But it was just basically Vince just apparently got it in his head one day that he wanted to change One Man Gang into Akeem as a rib on Dusty Rhodes. I mean, that's what the story that Bruce Pritchard said about it anyway. And it's not the only time there's kind of been ribs on Dusty, has there, from the WWF in this period.
But, I mean, famously, Virgil, of course, is a riff on Dusty's name.
Well, yeah, but Bobby Heenan came up with that one, and that one wasn't really anything more than a rib. And the other one as well, apparently, was Dusty was, you know, obviously the booker of the competition, and he lived in Cobb County, Georgia at the time. So they created the character. This is one of the reasons, anyway. I know he was, the boss man was, you know, a prison guard from Georgia, but the kind of... The name Bossman is, you know, the same as Booker, and as I said, that he was living in Cobb County, Georgia at the time, so that was linked also to a kind of rib or dig at Dusty Rhodes as well, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, I do want to talk about this a little bit, because yes, the African dream, Akeem, some of the mannerisms are clearly Dusty, the dream element of it, but some. I mean, we talked about the identity of Colonel Mustafa in the past, and also of Ian Mooney. Who is Akeem actually meant to be? I mean, like, he's clearly not African. I mean, there's, because one of the things I was thinking was like, could he be like a white South African? Is that like the idea that, or is it just that he's been infected with the soul of Slick and this?
Well, I always thought he was a white kind of South African as a kid, or he was from,
yeah, that was, know, my that was my assumption.
Or was it Zimbabwe or somewhere like that, where there was, you know, quite a lot of people, different people living in Africa at the time, in Zimbabwe anyway. But no, I didn't kind of put the two and two together about, you know, African Dream, American Dream, Dusty Rhodes till, you know, well later on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering, like, as a rib, how well does it work? No, I mean,
well, this is just Vince. He's a maniacal sociopath. You know, it doesn't have to make sense to anyone else but our Vince McMahon.
Well, I certainly thank him for the hours of entertainment he gave me and my brother years ago. I mean, they were pretty successful, weren't they? The Twin Towers, as they were known.
Oh no, they had a real good kind of heel run. They opposed Hogan quite a lot, really, didn't they? They were kind of the modern day Studd and Bundy. You know, kind of not the top heel all the time, but just kind of maybe one step down. But they're always there opposing Hogan, which I thought was quite interesting.
One thing, my final thing I did think is that I may have mentioned this on previous shows, but I'm aware that not all of our listeners, Alan, would have heard everything that I've ever recorded. And that is, I think it's at WrestleMania 6, Boss Man and Akeem face each other. And For whatever reason, Gorilla Monsoon's call, former tag team partners, Big Boss Man and Akeem, now have to face each other, is burned on my brain. So whenever former tag team partners face each other, I turn and say that. And if there's nobody there, which is 99% of the time, I'll just say it to myself, basically.
Well, yeah, they had that match at WrestleMania 6. I mean, that show was loaded. It was kind of a throwaway match. There was probably 14 matches on that card that year.
He was given a pretty undignified send-off, really, Akeem. Kind of an afterthought, because they transitioned straight from that to Bossman DiBiase, I want to say.
Oh yeah, I mean, he was done in the gimmick by, as we touched on, the end of 1990. I mean, his last match was against Jim Duggan, which he was on the losing end of.
I mean, DiBiase beats Bossman up before that match, and Akeem still loses in about 2 minutes. So, just gives you an indication of, you know, and what happens to him? Does he go off to WCW after that?
Well, yeah, he goes back to WCW. He goes back to WCW in 91. I do remember tail end of 91 he was involved. And then he kind of floated around for years. And then he randomly reappeared back in WCW in 95. And he was the US champion for a stage. Yeah, I don't know if you remember that. I think
part of the Conan. Dungeon of Doom.
Yeah, part of the Dungeon of Doom, that's right. And in the end, I think Conan beat him for the belt. But that was weird. In 95, he got a run as kind of the secondary champion in WCW.
Well, our best wishes are with Akeem. Currently, because I know he's been involved in some turmoil recently with the things that have been happening in Louisiana.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just a shame that he's not a drug addict, otherwise he would have got help from WWE.
Why don't we move on, Alan?
Well, you know, the next question then is, Dear Alan and Parv, how did Kamala become a good guy in 1993? And that's from Carl Harris in England. Again, doesn't stipulate where in England, so it'd be great to know, Mr. Harris, or Carl, sorry, where you're actually from. So, Kamala becoming a good guy in 1993, did this happen?
Yes, it did indeed happen, and once again, our link is Slick. So, just by chance, Alan, you've asked two Slick-related questions in a row here. Slick became a reverend in early 1993, late 1992, and became a good guy. Do you remember this? The Reverend Slick? And Kamala had been increasingly mistreated by the handler.
Well, what do we class as mistreated here? I mean, what was portrayed on TV to me was a little light bit of shoving. You know, was it any worse than that?
I think that they started kind of hitting him a bit more and berating him. Kamala was being managed by Harvey Whippleman at this time. This is kind of mid to late 92. And they actually teased this for quite a long time. I think Does Kamala wrestle on SummerSlam 92, I want to say? You can see a bit of
it. He's on the losing end with The Undertaker in, I think, in 92 at SummerSlam, and I think they had a casket match at Survivor Series 92 as well.
I mean, Kamala does get increasingly abused by Kim Chi in particular around this, around that sort of time.
Which, linking in Kim Chi, who was playing Kim Chi at this time?
And Kim Chi, in a link back to our first question, was the Brooklyn Brawler. It was Steve Lombardi. So all three of our questions are linked this week. Yes, so what happened is that the Reverend Slick wanted to take Kamala under his wing, show him the ways of the Lord, and basically try to civilize the, you know, the Ugandan savage. He cuts a number of really interesting promos near the start of this, where he does the whole kind of, you know, black southern preacher deal, where he's talking about, you know, testify and can I get a witness and all of this sort of thing. And, yeah, it's really quite interesting to watch that stuff. And he's trying to, like, teach Kamala how to be a better person through the ways of Christ. I mean, looking at it in some ways, you could see that this is maybe a distasteful kind of parody of the Christianizing efforts of the Jesuits back in the Victorian period.
I think it's interesting, Slick as well. The ways that he wants to teach Kamala things is, let's take him down to the 10-pin bowling alley and let's teach him how to bowl. I don't know if anyone wants to check out the commercial tape, the Coliseum video, where Invasion of the Body Slammers. Kamala's all over that videotape. He's in a bizarre, weird kind of match with Doink the Clown. He's in a battle royal, and then he's taught how to bowl. So if you want to see Slick teaching Kamala how to get a strike, that's the video for you.
Well, that's probably the highlight of this entire deal, is the bowling, because they spend quite a long... Is it Lord Al who's with them?
Yeah.
So, I mean, Slick is basically showing him how to bowl, and Kamala's... I mean, he's portrayed as almost being mindless, isn't he? Like, he may have special needs, let's say, because... You know, he's trying to teach him how to bowl, and he goes, you know, he starts walking down the wrong aisle, and, you know, he's only been in the USA for 10 years at this point, and he's still struggling with really basic concepts. But then it does end with a happy, doesn't he get a strike at the end of it?
Yeah, he gets a strike at the end of it, which, you know, makes everyone go home happy. But I have got another distinct memory. When Raw was filmed at the Manhattan Center, they had the kind of balconies, and I'm sure, it's a very vague memory, I've not seen the footage in years, of him wandering around the balconies with Slick trying to chase him to get him back to the ring. I don't know if you do remember this.
No, I haven't seen this one. Well, this happened on Raw, did it?
Yeah, this definitely happened on Raw. He's wandering around, as I said, the Manhattan Center in the bleachers, or, you know, in the balcony. And yeah, I'm going to have to find that for you and send that over to you. But he does feature up until, you know, he does his face turn in January 93. And he's around in, you know, in this run till, you know, middle of the year. I think his last match was on Raw, funnily enough. He had an IC title match against Shawn Michaels that he lost in 11 minutes.
Yeah, so I mean, a few things happen with this. First of all, that they really built towards a WrestleMania match that never actually took place. I want to say it was, I'm trying to remember who it was against now, because I was watching a lot of this footage from early 93, you know, each week in the run, and I'm trying to remember which match they were building towards. I think it was Kamala versus Bam Bam Bigelow.
No, that sounds about right, actually. That does stand out to me. He was on the March 2 WrestleMania show, I think, as well.
Yeah, even on that show, they're hyping up this match against Bigelow, and I think it was cut due to time. I actually want to say it's because Hulk Hogan spent too long giving out Money Inc.'s money. I think that's the thing that took a lot of time up on that, and also the Undertaker's chloroform, you know, because he gets... Giant Gonzalez chokes him out, doesn't he?
Yeah, how would you be pissed? You'd be really pissed off if you lose your payoff because of a timing issue, especially at WrestleMania.
Yeah, and I want to say that these days they would just cut that match to 18 seconds to make sure that the guys were going to pay off, rather than actually cut the match entirely. Yeah, so, I mean, what else happened?
Well, he was on about four Raws that year, wasn't he? And this run, I think.
Well, sometime after WrestleMania 9, like, within a couple of weeks, Slick kind of disappears from, like, he stops being around, and Kamala's basically just on his own, but still as a babyface. He does have a couple of matches with Kim Chi, who he defeats. In fact, at a March to WrestleMania show, for example, he beats him, feuds with Doink for a little bit. I think one of his big rivals was Mr. Hughes. He had a good couple of matches with Mr. Hughes.
Yeah, he got beat by Mr. Hughes at a King of the Ring qualifying match. He got beat by count out there.
One of the things that Kamala was doing quite a lot during this time was he would beat people. So he'd like have Mr. Hughes beaten, as he does at that King of the Ring match, for example. But he pins them when they're on their stomach, so it's not a proper pin. And when Slick was there, one of the things that Slick would do is he'd kind of encourage him to roll over, and then the crowd would get into it, trying to say, you know, turn him over, turn him over. That's what happens in the Kim Chi match, for example. Obviously, Slick is gone by the time the King of the Ring is there, so he doesn't turn him over, and Kamala ends up kind of getting up and wandering out the ring and loses by countout because he doesn't have anyone there to tell him how to do the pinfall. So if anything, Kamala's going backwards during this.
Yeah, is he the Benjamin Button of WWF? you know, I mean, because he's running around in Dallas in Fort Worth and places like that for World Class in the 80s, beating guys and pinning them. And, we're now, 9 years removed, and he's forgotten, a basic lateral press.
If I was to point to two matches for people to seek out from this run, one of the ones is that Kim Chi one. From the March to WrestleMania, not because of the match, but because of what happens afterwards, which is truly some of the most bizarre stuff I've ever seen, because Slick gets Kim Chi's helmet, puts it on in a kind of Michael Jackson manner, and starts like doing like shucking and jiving, and then he puts the hat on Kamala, who's really scared, and then tries to get Kamala to dance with him. But Kamala doesn't dance. It's a very strange set. It's almost like he was trying to Akeem Kamala in a way. It's kind of very unusual. The other match I'd point to is Money Inc. and Mr. Hughes versus Kamala and the Nasty Boys. And I mention that because, to me, that seems like a very strange matchup. DiBiase and Kamala in the same ring against each other. And there's a little bit of business at the start of that where... Ted tries to buy Kamala off. He gives him like a wad of $100 bills, and Kamala doesn't know what to do with it and gives it to Slick, and then Slick gives it all away. So
well, Ted's a bit daft there. I mean, if he'd given the money to the Nasty Boys, they'd have been thanks Ted, and they'd be gone and just leave Kamala, against three guys. So that was a bit of a mistimed thing there by Ted DiBiase.
By my calculations, in April of '93, he lost an awful lot of money. So.
Yeah, between that and WrestleMania, when it was all given away, that's for sure.
All right, well, why don't we head over now to the event centre with Justin JT Rosero. And when we come back, we may hit a longer topic.
Let's take you down to the event centre.
All right, thanks, Parvin Allen. JT Rosero here in the Event Center on Letters from Kayfabe. Hope you're all enjoying this week's show. Still to come here tonight, we're going to be looking at the legendary Piper's Pit, starring Roddy Piper, of course, the great talk show that aired across WWF programming for decades on and off. So stay tuned for that. Here tonight, though, I'm taking you back to 1995, October 9th, to be specific, Monday Night Raw from Grand Rapids, Michigan at the Grand Center. And we had a massive match on that show, a really big match for this time period. That was Davey Boy Smith, Owen Hart, and Yokozuna battling Diesel, Shawn Michaels, and The Undertaker. Match went 11:46. The British Bulldog actually pinned Diesel after Yokozuna hit a leg drop behind the referee's back. And then after that was when the fun started. Diesel, Michaels, and Taker just destroyed by all their opponents, plus King Mabel and Dean Douglas. And it was in that brawl that The Undertaker broke his eye socket, thanks to King Mabel, who hit a leg drop on him. Taker would be out of action for 2 months and knocked him off at In Your House 4. And, of course, he'd come back with the Phantom of the Opera mask that he would have until early 1996. It was an interesting episode, too. It was around this time that Bill Watts took over as Booker. And his fingerprints were all over the product at this time. Tons of strong heels, a lot of realistic kind of programming, more hard-hitting matches. And it was something that was a bit of a precursor to the Attitude Era coming off of a very soft 1995 and late 94, really, to be fair. And a lot of the cartoonish characters, kind of gimmicky storylines. But it was around this time that things did take more of a darker turn, more hard-hitting action, more focus on the in-ring product instead of other ancillary things. So it's actually kind of a cool time period. You can actually listen to more about it when Scott, my partner Scott Criscoll, and myself talked to James Dixon, author of Titan Sinking and the series of books that followed. And, of course, he talked about that time period both in the book and on our show. So you can go back to PlaceMation.com, search James Dixon. You can find that. You can find all of our other episodes of podcasts on iTunes at the PTBN Pop, PWO, PTBN, and Place to Be podcast feeds. And, of course, all of our written pieces as well. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. I am JT Rosero. I am out. I will be back next week. And, of course, still to come, the lads talking Piper's Pit. And next week, stay tuned as well, because we're going to be looking at the management decisions of Bobby Heenan, a really cool topic, because he's made some interesting ones during his time as manager, and the boys will be talking about that. So until next week, I'm out. Everyone take care.
All right. Well, thank you for that, JT Rosero. Fascinating as ever. And I think we've just got time for one more question, Alan.
Yeah, we've got one more here. This is a really good one. Dear Alan and Parv, I was really interested a few weeks ago when you talked about Roger's Corner and Victory Corner with Roger DeBoard. Can you tell me now about Piper's Pit? So that's from Charles Lossing in Little Rock, Arkansas. So Piper's Pit, Charles, it ran, it was a mainstay on WWF TV from, I would say its main run was 84 to 87. Would you say that's fair, Parv?
Yes, and then all subsequent ones are basically just callbacks to that era, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, he had a brief one in 89 again, but then anything after that was kind of, they rolled him out on TV, you know.
Nostalgia pops, basically.
Yeah. Well, you know, up until pretty much, you know, his last appearances before his passing on TV. But initially, Piper's Pit, it consisted of, you know, thin walls with a Scottish plaque in the centre, and then posters of Piper, and black and white posters. It kind of changed over the years, but that was kind of its initial kind of basic thing. It was a step up a little bit from the Rogers and Victory Corner kind of set, which was sparse and basic, but it still wasn't quite there to a flashy set that we'd see in later years, was it?
No, but I would say that kind of 84, 85 set that you're talking about, if I was to picture Piper's Pit, that's the one I tend to picture. Would you picture that one as well?
Yeah, because that's the one where you got the most infamous angle, sorry, with Jimmy Snuka, where the kind of set falls down. So yeah, that's the one that, you know, most people are familiar with. But I also like the one from 87 time, where it was more with chairs in there, and it was more like a castle or something like that, because they used that one for the Hogan-Andre angle for WrestleMania 3, didn't they? There were so many interesting things that happened on Piper's Pit, you know, that summed up WWF as a kind of era and how it was changing at the time. So many interesting things. Is there anything that caught your eye, Parv, going through the footage?
Well, I watched quite a lot of the ones from 1984. And one of the ones that really caught my eye was an early one, I think the third one ever, with Dr. D, David Schultz, where Schultz basically openly says, I've been around the AWA and I can't get a proper fight, and now I've come to WWF and I'm finding the same thing. And that really stunned me, because they mentioned AWA on air, which really is quite rare at this time. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, they have the stuff here where they mention that on air, and, you know, like we touched on one of the previous episodes, they mentioned New Japan after this, but it was still quite wild that openly on air he would mention, you know, a rival group where he came from. But there was also someone else that was kind of mentioned that you didn't expect when you were going through this footage, wasn't there, Parv?
Yes, so the very next interview was with Tony Garea. This is still in February of 84, and he's basically, his line is, you know, you're a five-time world tag team champion with different partners, Tony Garea. That means you're a liability. That means you've lost five times. You know, clearly the common denominator is that you're a loser type of thing. And all the way throughout their interview, they openly mention Rick Martel, who, if he wasn't the AWA champion at the time, was just about to be, and he was definitely an AWA wrestler at that time. So mentioning a wrestler who's not part of the company at the time, very rare as well. During this period. So those are two that really caught my eye. There are many other memorable ones, but I just thought that that was some interesting kind of, you know, off the beaten track stuff to mention.
Yeah, I mean, he coined some, you know, famous lines throughout this Piper's Pit run. I mean, the most famous one when he interviewed Frank Williams, you know, kind of just the jobber guy who just kind of slouched in the chair, kind of relaxed, trying to talk to Piper. Piper just berates him and tells him he's worthless and beats him up and then throws him through a curtain. And then Piper just basically looks in front of the camera and says, just when you think they've got the answers, I change the questions, which is still an awesome line to this day. You know, really effective line. So kind of Piper, this really helped Piper as a character, the Piper's Pit kind of segment, didn't it? It built him up as this kind of guy who would just berate all the heels, berate all the faces and suck up to all the heels, really.
And if you haven't seen the Frankie Williams one, that is definitely, I would say, one of the top kind of five most memorable ones. Would you agree?
Yeah, it was. I mean, all of these are really, you know, good to watch. You can watch them all on YouTube and Daily Motion. They don't really go longer than 3 or 4 minutes, you know, an episode. So, you know, you can consume 2 or 3 in one sitting without feeling like you've watched much. But he did do some stuff that was quite close to the bone as well. There was one interview in particular, Parv, wasn't there, with Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson?
Yeah, I actually thought that he was basically being openly racist to both of them. Can you remember any of the lines he used? I think he, I can't remember exactly what he said now, but it's basically, you know, can you name any famous black people or something? And he mentions, who does he mention now?
Well, I know he has the line at the, he kind of treats them as just muscle heads with no brains throughout it as well, and saying that they were the first kind of black tag team champions and touching on that at the start of the interview. So there was kind of racial undertones throughout
it. The one with Tito Santana as well is pretty, you know, he's trying to insinuate that he's lazy and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Did you like the one that he did with Bruno Sammartino in the ring at Madison Square Gardens? Did you watch that one?
I didn't. I have seen that before. Why don't you remind us what happened?
Well, basically, Sammartino refuses to participate in the interview until Orton, who was Roddy Piper's kind of ace, who was his bodyguard throughout this, he asked him to leave the ring. So eventually leaves the ring. Those two are chatting. Piper says, "You're no good. Your son's no good. You know, I'm in my prime. You're washed up. Your prime was 15 years ago." And he attacks him. But in the end, Bruno Sammartino gets the upper hand, and the heels kind of get out of the ring and scurry away. But yeah, I mean, he does mix it up with everyone and anyone really on these. You know, anyone that's kind of the main guys at the time.
You can kind of follow wrestling history really by watching the Piper's Pit, because you get a sense of who's around, what the angles are, and it actually goes back to something that we were looking at a few weeks ago, Alan, where do you remember Vince on Victory Corner was saying that 1984 is going to be the most tumultuous year in wrestling history? Yeah. And I mean, the guys who just come through here is like a who's who of talent from other promotions, you know, Dynamite Kid, the Briscoe Brothers, Sergeant Slaughter, Ken Patera, another AWA guy, you know, Barry Windham, Florida guy at that time, Tony Atlas, a Georgia guy, you know, they're all, you know, Buddy Rose from Portland, Heenan, of course, Murdoch and Adonis. There are so many, Blackjack Mulligan.
I mean, Dr. D, yeah, you know, there's, like we said.
The list goes on and on of all of the kind of the talent that he takes. And all of these people are on, you know, in that early 85, 1984 type period. There was one other one that caught my eye, actually, that I think is worth mentioning before we wrap up on this topic. Did you see the one from 84 with Jack Tunney in an early appearance?
I briefly watched it. Is this when Jack Tunney's rather portly?
This is when Jack Tunney is, yes, a rather larger than you remember him. September the 16th, 84. And he's introduced as the vice president of the WWF. So this was a kind of pre-president Jack Tunney. So I didn't know that I know the Japanese guy was the president before him, but I didn't know that Tunney had served as the VP at this time.
Yeah, it was quite interesting because this was exactly when this was on, was when the president actually stepped down. So this must have been, you know, a matter of weeks till Jack Tunney got the kayfabe presidency of the WWF. But yeah, I mean, throughout the 84, I mean, he did have Cyndi Lauper on a few times in 84 that really kind of helped Piper, elevate Piper as a kind of a character on his own right outside of wrestling, because there was a couple of ones where there was one famous one where Cyndi Lauper attacked Lou Albano. And Piper himself as well. You know, he did so much. I mean, the stuff with Mr. T as well, which he, you know, got some notoriety for. I mean, Mr. T had cooled off by this point in 86, but doing the boxing kind of stuff, that was there as well. And setting up WrestleMania 1 as well. But he always had Orton with him, didn't he, as his kind of henchman, his bodyguard, which kind of helped Piper be able to be that kind of cocky, arrogant heel.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the basic stick is that he's very, very rude to the baby faces and kind of quite smarmy with the villains. I guess it's easier if you've got a hard guy like the Ace standing behind you. I mean, one of the things that we should mention is that Piper was, of course, one of the people who was. He was probably the primary villain, wasn't he, on the Hogan cartoon? And
yes.
I think Piper's Pit is probably one of the reasons for that, because he's so prominent on the television product at this time.
Yeah, he's on most weeks, isn't he? And did you watch the Hulk Hogan Rock and Wrestle stuff when it aired over here originally? I mean, it was a few years after when it aired in the US. I think we may have got it in the, I would like to say, late 80s, early 90s.
I used to watch it, yeah.
It was on ITV over here, wasn't it, I think?
It was. Yeah. It was in that same sort of slot as Alvin and the Chipmunks, something like that, you know. I used to watch that. I'm trying to remember who was on the baddies.
You had Moolah.
Iron Sheik.
Nikolai Volkoff.
Volkoff, Piper. Those were the main ones.
Yeah, and there's a few
maybe
other...
Maybe Orton?
Yeah, there may be an Orton now. I mean, people are going to be shouting listening to this, saying, oh, there's such and such and such and such. I don't have exactly who it was in front of me, but there was
Andre was a goodie, wasn't he?
Yeah, Andre was in there, and he was kind of the lovable, dumb... So this was, you know, obviously pre-87 kind of Piper, because he was obviously still a heel. But he turned face, didn't he? And it was kind of through Piper's Pit that this happened. Do you remember what happened with that one, Parv?
Why didn't you remind me?
It was during, there was a flower shop, which the adorable Adrian Adonis had his segment, and there was a kind of flower shop versus Piper's Pit showdown. But it was basically Adonis and Bob Orton Jr. and Don Morocco that kind of destroyed, you know, Piper's Pit set. And Piper, who was kind of laying on the floor crippled, he was enraged, he was gained revenge by destroying Adonis's flower shop. And then while Piper's Pit would be quickly rebuilt, you know, the set, the flower shop never actually returned, so it was kind of a short run thing to kind of bring in the feud between Piper and Adonis that culminated at WrestleMania 3.
Yeah, I seem to remember what happened now. Doesn't Piper go away to film a movie, and in the interim Adonis takes the slot, and then when he comes back he's outraged to find Adonis has taken the talks, so that's how they do it?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I can just say this now, Alan. I never really took to Roddy Piper as a babyface. You know, there's the what's that thing they do at WrestleMania 5?
Not the Morton.
Morton Downey Jr.
Yeah, God, with the fire extinguisher.
With the fire extinguisher.
And then he kind of came and went all the time. He had WrestleMania 6 when he was dressed half black and half white against Bad News Brown.
Yeah, I was just never a fan of the babyface Piper, or as a commentator, really, or as the friend of Virgil. you know, he was just kind of annoying after that. I think the things that made him a really, like, the character is basically a heel. and he's a heel because he's annoying and he's rude and, you know, he's just an irritant, basically, isn't he? And, I don't think Piper was ever a cool heel. What do you think? I know friends of mine really, really love Roddy Piper, but just what are your views on the Piper character?
I thought the Piper character was awesome as a heel. I disagree with you really there, Pav. I thought he was really cool, you know, as a heel. He would say what he thought. He would bury all the faces. He'd say stuff about them that you were thinking. You know, and that type of heel naturally becomes cool to a segment of the audience. So I thought he was cool, but I agree with you more so on the fact that as a face, it kind of... his character was watered down a little bit. I did like his commentary at certain stages. One that stands out to me, he kind of used to root for Bret Hart quite a lot on commentary before the Bret Hart-Roddy Piper feud. Especially, I think it was Survivor Series 90, where I think Bret Hart's younger brother died the week of the show. So he was kind of very sympathetic towards the Hart family at the time and Bret Hart, and, you know, rooting for him to kind of win that Survivor Series match. But yeah, he was... Piper was never really the same as a face as he was a heel. I mean, he had that run in WCW as well, where we had some wacky kind of segments that hopefully you're going to cover in future episodes of the Where the Big Boys Play with Chad.
And there's just one thing that we do need to mention. Another of the very famous moments that happened on Piper's Pit, of course, was the attacking of it was the Andre heel turn. Didn't that all took place? You know, the cross, and it wasn't that all on a Piper's Pit?
Yeah, that was the whole thing where he said, you're bleeding, you know, to Hogan when Andre ripped off the chain and they had the whole... Do you remember the big trophy that they had?
Yeah, that was right. Was it like one of them was the Wrestler of the Year? But
I think one was being undefeated for so many years, I think.
Right, yeah.
So... And the seed was set by, you know, Jesse Ventura and people like that were saying, well, how come you've been undefeated, yet your best friend will never give you a shot at the title? So that whole feud was kind of a bit weird, because this is Hogan all the time. I mean, there's things with Hogan you don't agree with, yet he was still the face. So he never gave Andre a shot. Andre was undefeated, you know, on TV. You know, they promoted him as undefeated. So, you know, he had a legitimate gripe there. And I think, you know, the heel turn had elements of, you know, other people would do the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I have always thought that Andre did deserve a title shot. But I guess he didn't have to, you know... tear the cross off his chest and make him bleed. And
well, you don't know. He could have always been, you know, at the bar with Hogan after a show, saying, "You know what, Hulk? Can we have a match sometime down the line? I think, you know, it would be a really good bout." And Hogan would always kind of, "Yeah, we'll talk about it soon, Andre. You go and talk to those women, drink your 50 bottles of beer, and, you know, that would go on maybe for, you know, a couple of years, and then, you know, enough's enough. You know, the big man, he wants his shot. So, you know, he had to take his matters into his own hands, get Bobby Heenan maybe to kind of give him that impetus to do it, and he called Hogan out and got what he wanted in the end. And then kind of Roddy Piper stands out to me. He was stood there the week after this happened. Hogan comes out all crestfallen, saying, "I don't know what I'm going to do. What am I going to do?" And then Roddy Piper kind of puts it to him, "What are you going to do, Hulk? You've got to answer the fans now." And Hogan kind of shouts, "Yes!" you know, really loudly, and, you know, it's a huge pop that set the match up. So that kind of was the last kind of thing that stood out to me about, you know, Piper's Pit at the time.
Yes. Okay. Well, I think we've given you a decent flavour of Piper's Pit. You know, if we had to give the top five ones are very well known, I think. The Frankie Williams one, the one where Hogan attacks, Andre attacks Hogan.
The snooker one.
The snooker one, with of course, the coconut. Any others?
Yeah, the one other than, it's like I said, the Cyndi Lauper attack.
Cyndi Lauper. I mean, in fact, all of the ones with Captain Lou running up to that are really worth watching.
Yeah, anything with Captain Lou running around on TV is, you know, always good value. I mean, his first guest was actually Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. He was kind of challenging Hogan for the title at the time, so that was his first guest. And as we kind of said, he went all the way up till, you know, right till the end, really, you know, coming out and doing things. I mean, he did come back in 2003 with it. And then in 2005, and then he did a segment at WrestleMania 21 interview in Austin. And that was the night after the Hall of Fame where he was inducted. So it was around up until the end. So it was good until it jumped the shark, which was, you know, when it came back in 89, I think that was, you know, it didn't need to come back after that.
I think the Morton Downey one is the ultimate jump the shark moment. Just one final thought before we wrap up here, Alan. Moolah, how the hell did she go on the cartoon?
Was there not a deal where Mad Maxine, do you remember Mad Maxine? Does that name ring a bell at all?
No, not really.
Mad Maxine was someone who, she was about 6'4", and she was brought in to kind of to kind of be the main female heel, and also on the cartoon, but they didn't work out with her in WWF for whatever reason, and then they had to rework the cartoon and put Moolah in instead. So I think that was the story behind that one, where Moolah wasn't originally intended for it, but they had no one better for the role at the time, so they had to stick old Moolah in.
And, I mean, I think you could make a case that, because obviously she was the main villain behind the Cyndi Lauper story, wasn't she?
Yeah, so there was that kind of link there. She still was on screen, and also double-crossing people as Spider Lady or Lady X or whatever.
Just so people don't shout at us, should we go through, you know, the good guys on the show were JYD, Captain Lou, Andre the Giant, Wendy Richter, Superfly Snooker, Hillbilly Jim, and Tito Santana. So those were the... Now, if I was to look at them... I'd say there's a curious mix of 84 baby faces and 85 baby faces there.
Because yeah,
Tito is bigger in 84 than he is in 85. And
oh, yeah, and then he just drops off, really, doesn't he, into tag teams.
JYD, I don't think, is even... He comes in 85, I want to say, or... He seems to be featured a lot more in 85.
Yeah, I mean, I think he comes in late 84 time. I mean, I know he's on WrestleMania 1 show, so he probably debuted... Late 84.
And then the baddies, Piper, Iron Sheik, Volkov, Fabulous Moolah, Big John Studd, and Mr. Fuji. Bobby the Brain Heenan and Mean Gene Okerlund are in a few episodes as well. So,
well, none of them are voiced by the actual wrestlers, which was quite annoying, really. I always wanted, you know, the actual wrestlers to, you know, to play a bit more authenticity. But, you know, well, we're rating a kid's cartoon here. It was as good as it was going to be, really.
Well, it ran from September 85 to December 86. I just think it's curious that to my mind, it's our cast of characters are stuck in kind of late 84, early 85 land. But there's obviously a lag between, you know, animation takes some time to make as well, so...
Well, that was the problem then. They had to ship this stuff, get animated, and then in wrestling, as you know, 6 months, a year is a hell of a long time, and you might have a whole new roster by then.
Wendy Richter's ancient history by the time it actually aired, you know, so...
Yeah, so that's the problem.
All right, well, I think we've talked a lot about Piper's Pit and about the Hogan cartoon, so if people want to write it in, Alan, and get hold of us, how can they do it?
Well, the best way to get hold of myself, Parv, is via Twitter, as always. It's at Alan, that's with two L's, A-L-L-A-N _cheapshot. Follow me, I post all sorts of stuff, most days, history, kind of on this day in wrestling, playlists, GIFs of all sorts of stuff. Yeah, so that's the best way of getting hold of me and yourself, Parv.
Yeah, and I will say, if you're a Twitter person, you owe it to yourself to follow Alan, because you'll see random stuff like Rick Steiner beating the absolute crap out of Goldberg, for example, which I very much enjoyed a couple of weeks ago. Yes, I am at Jerry Von K. So, yes, and I think the best thing to do is to start your question, Dear Alan and Parv, and copy both of us in, and that way it will definitely hit both of our radars and we'll catch the question. Yes, I can't promise gifts on mine. You'll just see me once in a while. I don't really know what I post about. Nothing, really.
Nothing and everything.
Nothing and everything, basically. You know, Grand Wizard on commentary in 1983. That was one of mine recent. Okay, and any other ways? Yes, you can get in touch on Facebook, on the PWOPTBN Facebook page. You could also make a visit to Pro Wrestling Only, where we have an ongoing thread. Those are probably the best ways of getting in touch. I think, without further ado, Alan, we will say goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Right now, ladies and gentlemen, we should like to take you to a feature in the World Wrestling Federation magazine. And indeed, a feature right here on Championship Wrestling. With that in mind, we take you now to Piper's Pit.
Well, here we are again in Piper's Pit, the place that pulls no punches at all. I have finally found another man that had guts enough to come on and face possible harassment from Piper's Pit. His name is Dr. David Schultz. It's as simple as this, Doctor. I have a question that has been brought to my attention that I know the answer to, but the public doesn't. And I know for a fact that you have asked for fights from anybody in the WWF. You have asked for fights with Rocky Johnson. You have asked for fights with Tony Atlas. And I myself saw Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas in the asking for those fights actually break down. All of a sudden, Rocky Johnson gets a sore rib. All of a sudden, Tony Atlas has got to go home and plow the fields. Tell us, what is it like to be such a fighter that intimidates other people so much that a man cannot even get a fight?
You know, I wrestled at the AWA a long time, and I went there and I begged. I got on my knees and I begged somebody to come out and fight me. Nobody wanted to fight me. Nobody thought they could match me in the ring. Nobody wanted to sign their name. So I come to the WWF, baby, where the toughest in the world is wrestling right now. And it seems like I'm having the same problem that I'm having everywhere else. Nobody wants to face me man to man and prove who is the best. And I want to say one other thing. It's a pleasure for me to be sitting out here with one man that feels no fear from anybody whatsoever, and that's you, Ronnie Piper. I want to tell you, it's a pleasure to know somebody like you.
Thank you. Just a few more truisms from the Pit of Piper. Thank you.